Sarah Timmer Harvey spoke about translation of the novel What I Would Rather Not Think About, which is shortlisted for International Booker Prize 2024 in this episode. Sarah is a translator and writer currently based in Woodstock, New York. She holds an MFA from Columbia University in New York and a BA from Southern Cross University. Sarah's translation of Iantha Posthuma's novel, What I Would Rather Not Think About, was published by Scribe in 2023. Reconstruction, the translation of stories written by the Dutch Surinamese writer Karin Emat Mukrim, was published by Strangers Press in 2020 as part of their Verzet series. And their translation of Thistle by Nadia De Vries will be published by New Menard Press in 2024. Sarah's translation of Dutch language poetry and prose have appeared in Modern Poetry in Translation, Asymptote, Gulf Coast Journal, The Los Angeles Review, and elsewhere. Born in Australia, Sarah lived and worked in the Netherlands for 14 years before moving to New York City in 2013. You can buy the novel What I Would Rather Not Think About using the link given in the show notes. You may please give us your feedback on this episode using the Spotify app. So, Sarah, welcome to Harshaniyam. Lovely to have you with us today.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Now, you are born in Australia and graduated from the United States from Columbia University.
That's right.
What drew you to Dutch literature?
Well, I lived in the Netherlands for 14 years, and I consider it as much my home as Australia, where I was born and raised. For such a small country, the Netherlands is really bursting with a lot of literary talent and kind of equally passionate readers. So it's hard not to be attracted to Dutch literature. A lot of Dutch writing tends to be quite experimental and boundary pushing, which I really enjoy as a reader. Even before I became a translator, when I was reading Dutch books, I often found myself translating the novels and poetry in my head.
So you learned Dutch after moving to Netherlands, or?
Yeah, I learned when I moved there. I was supposed to move for 1 year, and I ended up staying for 14 years.
You worked there for some time. You worked there for 14 years.
I did. I actually have never had an adult job in Australia. My professional history has only happened in the Netherlands, and I immigrated to the Netherlands when I was quite young, and so I've never actually had a grown-up job in Australia. I'm more in the Netherlands and now in America, where I still live.
You are a writer too. You published books. Now, as an artist, your creative urge to express, you can do that in writing. So why translate?
That's a really interesting question. I am a writer and I still write. I'm actually very slowly working on a novel between translations. But I find translation equally as fulfilling, if not more so fulfilling than writing. I tend to get really excited about my translations in a way that I don't about my own writing, and I've been thinking about this recently, wondering what it is, but I think it's the collaborative aspect of it, because even if I'm not directly working with the original author, I'm engaging with a text that's not mine and creating something from it, using someone's art, and I think that that's just so exciting. That might change again. I'm not going to box myself in or limit myself. I may prioritize writing again at some point in the future. I really do think that the key to creative fulfillment is to do what excites you and scares you. And when it gets too comfortable, you change it up.
And I believe it will have a beneficial impact on your writing too when you're translating.
Oh, absolutely. It completely does. Although I do have to be careful when I'm really immersed in a novel, or some amazing poetry. I do find myself sometimes taking on the style of the novel or poetry that I'm working on. But yes, absolutely, it's always inspiring, like reading any writing is.
When it comes to translating it into English, I gather that the English, of course, the way the idioms are used, idiomatic usage, the way certain phrases, you construct certain phrases, it differs from Australian English to English that is used in the United States, and of course, British English is a bit different, right? When you are translating, what is that you do? Because Netherlands doesn't belong to any of these countries.
Before I start any translation, I always ask the publisher and the writer, if I'm able, what English are we aiming for? What is the logical English to be translating into? Because there are so many Englishes, and I'm lucky to have, you know, lived in Australia. I was educated, you know, in British English, and I now live in America, so I'm able to draw on all of those things. But even outside of the countries that I've sort of directly experienced, I like to research all the various Englishes around the world. I think it's really important as a translator to kind of understand how each generation and each region are using English and expanding it. I also always search for a model for the narrative voice, and sometimes that comes from novels that have been recently published in English or around the same time period as the English I'm trying to translate into. But it can just as easily come from film, television, social media, and even my friends and family around the world.
You use any tools or any particular dictionaries for these things? Or, of course, you're exposed to this, but you also need some help, right?
Sometimes I do get a little confused, and especially with slang, and I'm thinking, well, I have heard someone use that in this country, but is that typical? So I do always cross-reference and see how is it being used, it's sort of in the local vernacular, before I throw it into a translation.
Does editing play any part in this when it gets published in different countries? Because one of the translators told me, when it gets published in Britain, the editor comes into picture sometimes.
I think it depends on the book and the publisher. For this particular book, there weren't really many changes apart from the cover. The cover is different in each of those regions, but it can involve editing to suit a particular market. It just depends on what the publisher wants, really.
One of the other ones, other book that you translated is titled as Reconstruction, right? It's a collection of stories by, interestingly, a Dutch Surinamese writer, Karin Namath Mukrim. Can you please tell us a bit about the book and the writer?
Yes, Karin Namath Mukrim is actually such an incredible writer, and I'm always wondering why more of her work isn't translated, because she is an award-winning Dutch writer. I could be wrong about this. I don't have the information in front of me, but I think that she's published five novels. And I love her writing because it really shifts between Suriname and it and the Netherlands, and it is very singular writing. I don't think I've ever read anything like it. I think that she has a very unique view of the Netherlands, and the short stories that I translated really do travel between both regions, and some of them are magic realism, some of them are stories about various generations living in Suriname. I love them. I really enjoyed translating that, and it was part of a series that was published by Strangers Press in the UK called Verzet, and there's a whole set of books by various Dutch writers translated by some really talented translators. I would encourage everybody to read them.
Now, this particular book, which is long listed for International Booker, what I would rather not think about. How did you come across this book, Sarah?
Oh, that's a lovely story, actually. I've been a big fan of Jente's work for a long time. I adored her debut novel, People with No Charisma. And right at the start of my translating career, I even approached her former publisher about perhaps translating it. I hadn't published very much at the time, and I don't think they were particularly impressed with me. And Jente was also in the process, I didn't know this, but Jente was also in the process of parting ways with that particular publisher. So it didn't work out at the time, but I sort of put it aside and continued on with other projects. And then we cut to 2020, so the pandemic year. And one of my dear friends in the Netherlands sent me a pandemic care package. And part of the care package was this book with a note from my dear friend saying, I haven't been able to put this book down. You have to read it. So, of course, it being the pandemic, I didn't have much else to do. I immediately read it and fell very much in love, as I had with the debut novel. And I reached out to her publisher. She'd since switched to another publisher, Pluim, who publish a lot of my favorite Dutch writers. And they were luckily just as keen to have me translate it as I was to translate. So it all worked out this time.
So what is this, that particular aspect of the book which you really liked about?
I think the way that Jente looks and explores human relationships is really fascinating. I think that her ability to handle such a tragic subject with humor and compassion, it just really speaks to me.
Now, this book is published by Scribe Books in USA and UK. Can you tell us a bit about this publisher, this independent publisher, Scribe Books?
Oh, yes, I'm very happy to. I love Scribe. They are an independent publisher that was set up by a man called Henry Rosenblum in the 1970s in Melbourne, Australia, my favorite city. And they've got offices in Melbourne and London and the US, and they publish around 65 titles per year, fiction and nonfiction. And they're very committed to translated fiction. They publish a lot of really good translated fiction. In fact, one of the other books on the International Booker long list, Mater 210, is also a Scribe title. So yes, I was really pleased when they picked up What I'd Rather Not Think About, and particularly excited to work with an Australian publisher. I worked primarily with Marika Webb-Pullman, who is the publisher in the Melbourne office, and I would say one of the best and most thoughtful editors in the business.
This, please tell us about the author, Jente Postuma.
Oh, yes. Okay. Jente is an incredible writer and also one of the funniest people I know. She worked as a journalist for many years, and also published quite a bit of short fiction in some very well-known Dutch journals and magazines. Before she published her debut novel, People with No Charisma, in 2016. People with No Charisma was nominated for several awards in the Netherlands and very well received. She published her second novel, What I'd Rather Not Think About, in 2020, and that was shortlisted for the European Union Prize for Literature. It's been translated into multiple languages, Spanish, Bulgarian, German, and English, of course. And it was also longlisted for the International Booker Prize this year. She has recently also published a Dutch language book called Hex, 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 which is an exploration of witches and the representation of women in Dutch folklore.
You are translating it too?
I would love to, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that one is. It's very focused on Dutch folklore, but I find it fascinating.
This novel is about fraternal twins, and one of them is grieving. Please introduce the novel, its theme, and its characters.
Yes, What I'd Rather Not Think About is about two twins, indeed. They are called One and Two. We never learn their names in the novel. But the two of them grow up in each other's pockets, but they slowly start drifting apart the closer they get to adulthood. And in adulthood, they become quite estranged, with rather tragic consequences. I think that this novel examines the kind of unimaginable grief that comes from losing a sibling or a close family member. But I think it's also a really good exploration of human relationships and how so many of us fail to listen to other people when they tell them and show them exactly who they are and how they feel. I think Maya Angelou said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. And it sounds straightforward, but I think it's something a lot of people fail to do because they're so attached to their idea of someone and can only look at them through that one particular lens. I think that What I'd Rather Not Think About really brilliantly explores this phenomenon and how it affects intimate relationships, but also our view of public figures, and how blind we can be to the true natures of certain powerful and famous people, even as they have shown us and told us exactly who they are.
See, this particular novel, it's a very difficult theme that she handles, right? Suicide of a fraternal twin and handling grief for most part of the book. But she handled it very well, and the book was very successful, of course. What do you attribute the success to?
That's a really good question. I think it's Jente's, as I mentioned earlier, Jente's unique ability to look at something and infuse it with humor, because that is real life. I think when we're grieving, it's not one note. We have good moments. We have bad moments. We look back and we can laugh at memories. We can recognize our blind spots. And I think that Jente does that so brilliantly in such understated language that it really speaks to people. It feels real.
Can you tell us about any interesting or challenging experience as far as translating the book is concerned? Or any interaction while you are translating you had with other? Any interesting anecdotal experience?
Yeah, okay. I think early on in the translation of this novel, before we had a publisher, there was a certain European literary arts funding institution that offered their support, but they also asked me if they could assess my translation first. I was actually really pleased because their support at the time could have really made all the difference in terms of which publishers would look at the sample and be interested in publishing what I'd rather not think about. And this was a real passion project for me, so I was really invested. In any case, I always think it's really good to get as many eyes on a translation as possible. I welcome criticism, and I think that it can only improve a text. But the feedback that I got from this particular institution was really brutal. They questioned in actually quite a rude and patronizing way some of the translated details about New York, my language and word choice, and they even questioned my ability to translate Dutch humor at all. They said I might be better suited to translating serious nonfiction books. I was really shocked because I'd already shown the draft to several people in the New York publishing industry, and they had found it very funny and hadn't raised any of the issues that this assessor from the institution had flagged. Nevertheless, I was really crushed, and that assessment really made me question my instincts as a translator and wonder if I was indeed up to the task, if I was going to do Jente's brilliant writing justice. So I asked for a meeting with the institution, and I really quickly realized that the people who had assessed my work didn't necessarily have any real knowledge about New York while I was living there. They weren't at all up to date with the kind of sort of humorous Gen X millennial voices that were being published in the UK and the US at the time. And some of their language and style notes just felt really outdated for the kind of narrated voice that Jente had written. But even after the meeting, I still thought, well, this is a well-known institution, I should adjust my translation. So I did. I did adjust it. But it felt really off. It didn't read as well. And I had another editor friend, an American editor friend, look at it. And the feedback was, it's not as funny. So after a lot of debate, I ended up reverting to my original and sending out my original, much longer sample to publishers.
How much time it took for you additionally?
Oh, I think around 6 months in total. But you know, there was back and forth, and I also like to put translations down and away. I always try to build in time to put something away and come back at it with fresh eyes. It's really important for my practice. But between the bad assessment and me deciding to send out my own version, only a few months. But anyway, I sent it out, and, well, Scribe and other publishing houses were interested. Scribe wasn't the only one who wanted to publish it. We went with Scribe in the end. But Scribe said one of the primary reasons they picked it up was for the humor, you know. And I think I really learned an important lesson from that experience, and that was to trust my gut. I think that input and feedback is really important for any manuscript or translation. But I think that even seasoned professionals and institutions can have their blind spots. And I think the way the industry is set up now, these kinds of institutions and funding bodies do really essential work in supporting writers and translators, but they aren't infallible. And I really wish that someone at the time had told me it was okay to push back if I felt something wasn't right. You know, I think that honing your own compass for what works and doesn't work in writing and translation is just as important as the language itself. And I think it's also really important to find readers that you can trust who can criticize your work in a way that is thoughtful and informed and aimed at helping you improve it. Working with Jenta on this book has been one of the most rewarding experiences I've had as a translator. I've gotten to know her as a person and deeply understand her writing. And I think building that kind of relationship with a writer as a translator is so wonderful and rewarding. And I'm excited that we're going to be working together again. We're going to be, I'm translating currently for Scribe again, her first novel, People with No Charisma.
Now, before we end it in the conversation, please read an excerpt from the novel, which you really liked. Any part.
And I also just wanted to give a little trigger warning for this because there is mention of suicide in the text. So if any listeners are uncomfortable, I'd suggest they now switch off. I used to sleep with a Continental Airlines poster above my bed. It was an image of the Twin Towers set against the pink evening light. Compared to the towers, the Statue of Liberty appeared minuscule in the foreground. Liberty looked like she was trying to set the towers on fire with her torch. I bought the poster at a flea market I went to every Saturday with my father. When I came home with it, my brother said, "That photo is inaccurate. In reality, the towers aren't the same height." I dreamed of seeing the towers up close. I didn't need to go inside them, and certainly didn't want to go to the top, although standing underneath the towers could also be risky. Ever since a famous pop star had jumped out of a hotel window in the city, closest to our own, and we learned from our mother that the self-inflicted death of a celebrity was usually followed by a wave of copycat suicides, we would look up to the top of every tall building we passed to see if there were any jumpers. Our parents were geologists, so they looked at the ground a lot. They both worked at the Geological Institute in the city. My mother was an expert in landslides, and my father did microscopic soil research. Whenever there was any dirt that needed excavating, my brother and I had to list the various layers of soil we observed. During our vacations in Sweden, we were constantly hacking away at the ground, searching for fossils that were at least 350 million years old. My parents didn't think anything younger than that was worth the trouble. I collected minerals and fossils, not because I thought they were beautiful, but because my mother also collected them. She displayed the most interesting specimens in every available corner of the house. The rest were stored in boxes underneath her bed, where my collection also ended up once I grew tired of it. My brother collected comic books, and my father collected old biscuit tins. One of the walls in the shed was covered entirely with tins that held all my father's screws and nails. He didn't organize the tins by their contents, but rather by color, just like the layers of soil on the geological chart on the opposite wall. Every layer was a different earth tone. I enjoyed being in the shed, looking at the colors and at my father's back as he opened tin after tin, searching for the right nail. My father also liked hanging out in the shed, presumably for the colors, because he wasn't much of a handyman. Though he acted like he was, in the same way he pretended to be a fun dad.
So nice, wonderful, wonderful to listen in your voice. Thank you for your time and patience, and wish you the very best for the competition.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed speaking with you.